Welcome to Inside Whitehall with me, James Starkey.
And me, Jonathan Gullis. We are delighted to have a guest with us today. That guest is Gareth Baker, Member of Parliament for Orpington, who's here to talk about the politics of London. The Greater London Authority is the body that governs London, the capital city of the United Kingdom, and home to 9 million people with a GDP of over £500 billion. The eventual successor to the Greater London Council, it came about to a backdrop of a wider push towards devolution. It consists of the London Assembly and a directly elected mayor. And as I say, we have Gareth, who was, before becoming the Member of Parliament, and before becoming, in the not so long ago, was made Minister for Sentencing under Rishi Sunak as Prime Minister. He has also previously served as leader of the Conservative Group on the London Assembly and was a councillor in Bexley as well. Gareth has also chaired the London Fire and Emergency Planning Authority during Boris Johnson's time as mayor. So there's no one better qualified than to tell us about London's political scene. Welcome, Gareth.
Good morning, both of you.
So we always like to start off by first of all asking our guests, what was the journey into politics? Why go into a world of politics? Was it a long-term dream, short-term dream? Was it an accident? What drove you into it?
When I was a child, I didn't really think about politics at all. I mean, I spent most of my time thinking about sport. But in my mid-teens, there was a dramatization of a book written by Geoffrey Archer called First Among Equals, which is a fictitious book about four members of parliament who get elected in 1964, and it traces their career over the next quarter of a century. One of them ends up becoming prime minister. You don't find out in the book until the final line of the final page which one it is, because there's this big tumultuous general election at the end, which ends up in a hung parliament, and the balance of power rests in the hands of one of these MPs. And he has to choose between Labour and Conservative as to who he's going to side with. And ultimately, you find out who that is. But it was dramatised on ITV, and it was an absolutely superb dramatisation. You can still get it on DVD. They built an 80% scale model of the House of Commons. Some of their other sets were really very well done. And as an MP now, I can walk around and see how they've got things right. They got parliamentary procedure broadly right as well, which is unusual for a drama. And I saw the first episode of that aged, I think, 14. And thought it was terrific. And I bought the book and I read it in about a week. And that suddenly woke me up to politics. I mean, to me at that time, I didn't realize how competitive politics was. And to me, it was like sport in suits. And I suddenly got very interested in that. And I went to see my local MP, who at the time was Sir Edward Heath, former Prime Minister. I wrote to him and, very precociously asked him how to go about becoming a Member of Parliament. And he invited me into surgery, and that just blew me away. The fact that I could sit across the table from a man who used to be prime minister and talk to him about politics was just amazing to me at that time. And that's how it sort of started, really. And I studied politics at university. I did a bachelor's and a master's degree. And I finished my master's in 1997, which, of course, was a bit of a dire year for the Conservative Party because Tony Blair swept the board. And that point, I decided it might be time for me to step into the ring and see what I could do to try to help the Conservative Party to recover. I didn't know how I was going to do that. And quite by chance, it turned out that the following year we had local elections. And being a Conservative back in 97, 98 was not a popular thing to be. So there was a shortage of local election candidates. And as it turned out, the ward that I had been raised in was needing a Conservative candidate. It was a relatively safe Conservative ward. And even then, And I got selected and got elected in 1998. And that sort of led on to the various other things. And eventually that led to the London Assembly in 2008, very much on Boris Johnson's coattails. That in turn led to me standing for Parliament in 2019 and arriving here. It was the culmination, really, of a very long-term ambition. It took a long time to arrive at it. Various other people have made a much quicker journey into Parliament, but it took me some time. But I've skipped a few steps, but that was the journey to sitting opposite you this morning.
And do you think in 97, when you kind of first started, when you decided to get involved, you said how long was it before you actually wanted to become an MP?
So back in my teenage years, I had three ambitions. I had two initially, and then I added a third. The first two were either that I was going to play rugby for England or I was going to win Wimbledon. And it didn't take too long to work out. I had neither the talent nor the application to achieve either of those. So I needed a longer term ambition that I could cling on to until middle age, and becoming a Member of Parliament seemed to fit the bill. So I sort of formed that ambition embryonically when I was a teenager. Never thought it would ever come to pass. But one way or another, it ultimately did.
Out of interest, London politics, because I know you well, Gareth, is how you came across your lovely wife.
It is.
And what's even more funny is obviously the story of being on opposing teams for the Conservative candidacy of the mayoralty of London, which I think you were on the losing team, were you not?
I was. So Cheryl was very involved in London politics. She'd been a Conservative Party agent, and she was much further down the career path than I was when we met. But she got involved with Geoffrey Archer's mayoral campaign team back in 1999. And I like Geoffrey Archer, of course. I read his book. That's what got me interested in politics. I wasn't completely convinced that Geoffrey Archer was going to be what we needed to win that election. But it wasn't really an anti-Archer move. It was more to get involved in something beyond simply being a councillor. I got involved in Steve Norris's mayoral campaign team. And Steve became, a sort of a distant friend. I mean, I bumped into him in the house last week. We had a really nice chat. He's a good guy. But Cheryl backed the winning horse on that occasion. Although, of course, other things happened afterwards. And eventually it was actually Steve that was the mayoral candidate.
Fantastic. So you've obviously had that journey there. And you've kind of gone through what some would to say it was a traditional Conservative journey. Councillor, obviously you had the London Assembly. Out of interest, you've got to London Assembly. How soon after you joined the Assembly did you become the group leader for the Conservative Party? So it was 08, was it, you came into the London Assembly. So how long, when did you ever become
longer than that. Well, 7 years. So I got elected in 2008. I was on the London-wide list. It's a proportional system. There's a constituency members, and there's also a list system as well, which is quite confusing for voters, but nevertheless, I wasn't expected to win in 2008, so much so that I didn't go to the count. The count takes place overnight and on the Friday, and it takes a very long time. And I was number three on the Conservative list. And for context, in 2004, we won one seat on the list. In 2008, we lost it because we gained a constituency. So we'd never even won two seats on the list before. So the idea of winning at number three was just not going to happen. It was a nice boost for my ego to be number three on the Conservative list, but winning wasn't expected to happen. So I went to work in the normal way on Friday, and I had a few whiskies to celebrate Boris's victory that night at home. Went to bed and got phoned up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was my wife who took the call, and it turned out it was a very drunk London campaign director in a black cab on his way home from Boris's victory party to inform me that I had won a seat on the London Assembly. And I assumed it was a wind-up, as you do at 3 o'clock in the morning. And then had to get out of bed and check my laptop to realise that actually, no, I had actually won this thing. And, you know, and was now going to be sort of flung onto this journey with, you know, a man who at that time and for many years after that was sort of a national phenomenon, Boris Johnson. And, you know, that was probably the luckiest break that I've had in politics, really, because that led on to, I stayed on the Assembly. I got re-elected in 2012. They moved me up to number two on the list in 2012, and I got re-elected. And then in 2015, James Cleverly, who was the member for Bexley and Bromley, was elected to Parliament in 2015. And so he wasn't going to contest the seat the following year in 2016. So I applied for and ultimately was selected for the Bexley and Bromley constituency. And that is what gave me all of the contacts and the exposure to Orpington, which is part of that constituency, which is, of course, now my parliamentary constituency. So that lucky break back in 2008 probably was the catalyst that led to everything that led me into Parliament.
And so on the, as you've touched on a couple of times, the kind of London Assembly, and when I was looking at this, you mentioned kind of off-air something which I straight away clocked, which I was like, I would just refer to it all. I think a lot of people refer to the Assembly as the GLA when it's not. And it's got three constituent parts.
Yes.
And so I thought we would just start, like, before we get into kind of some of the detail and how well does it work and could it be reformed or what have you. So basics wise, you also said on the proportional voting system, one of the problems is a lot of voters probably don't fully understand the dynamics of it, and they've obviously changed the mayoral system this year. So the London Assembly, what specifically does that refer to?
So the London Assembly is the 25 elected politicians whose job it is to scrutinise the activities of the Mayor of London and the functional bodies. So the GLA, the Greater London Authority, is the Mayor of London, the London Assembly, and the functional bodies. And the functional bodies are the London Fire Brigade, Transport for London, The mayor has a share of the Metropolitan Police. It would be inaccurate to say that he is wholly responsible for Metropolitan Police, because most of the funding actually comes from the Home Office. There's one or two other bits and pieces. The London Legacy Development Corporation, which is the successor to the Olympic Park. So it runs everything that happens.
That's still technically part of it all, is it?
Yes. Yeah. So the mayor didn't know that. Owns that, or the mayor runs that. Well, he owns it. So the Olympic Stadium, for example, although West Ham United play in it, they don't own it. It's owned by the Mayor of London. And there's other things as well, the Old Oak Common Development Corporation as well. So there's various things that the mayor is responsible for, but the London Assembly aspect of that is to scrutinise everything that the mayor does and the functional bodies, which work obviously in the mayor's name, and to investigate other issues that might matter to Londoners. So they might not necessarily be within the mayor's orbit for delivery, but nevertheless, they could be things that matter to Londoners, so the Assembly will take an interest in them.
So, because I think, and I've seen this when I look at sometimes things that go on in Scotland, it's how much power do those bodies have? So if you look at the kind of Scottish Assembly, and speaking to some friends that are Conservative MSPs, you know, the frustration is they don't always actually feel also that they can properly hold the First Minister or in London, the Mayor to account. And so I'm sure, like, certainly Londoners would have seen, you know, BBC London, and they would be familiar with whether it was Boris or Sadiq sat in front of the Assembly taking questions as he does. That's the main thing. But the central, it is the case that it was set, the reason it was set up is to provide the scrutiny. But does it have any kind of powers?
It can scrutinise the mayor, and it can, under certain circumstances, it can summons the mayor and anybody working for any of the functional bodies to appear in front of them and answer their questions. However, in theory, it has the power to veto and amend the mayor's budget and mayoral strategies, but it's a power that's never been properly exercised, because written into the 1999 GLA Act, it can only do that if 2/3 of the Assembly members agree. And because of the electoral system, you're never going to get to that number, because you would need Labour members to vote against their own, in this case, their own mayor. And similarly, when Boris Johnson was mayor, you would have needed Conservative members to vote against him in order to impose an alternative. And because of that, it lacks teeth, really, you know, and that's a problem, because the mayor, every mayor has worked out that they can effectively ignore the Assembly. They can't refuse to turn up for mayor's question time, and they cannot refuse a summons. But the Assembly cannot really direct the mayor to do anything. And that is a weakness, I think, in the system, which isn't to say that the Assembly is incapable of throwing light on what the mayor is doing. There's been some really good work, and particularly, I have to give a shout out here to my successor as the member for Bexley and Bromley, Peter Fortune. He and the entire Conservative group, but spearheaded largely by him, has done very, very good work at exposing some of the stuff around the ultra low emission zone extension, for example, and has made the mayor's life very uncomfortable. But what they haven't been able to do is reverse any mayoral decisions. And the mayor knows that. So the mayor knows that he can have an uncomfortable 2 hours at mayor's question time, and then just carry on as he was before. And
we've never even had a simple majority, have we, of the Assembly?
We have had simple majority. So it is certainly my final few years on the Assembly, final 4 years, I think. The mayor's budget never got a majority of support in the Assembly, but because it didn't get 2/3 majority going the other way, the mayor's budget by default was always approved.
But we've had a party that's had an app just.
No, we haven't. So I think Labour have had 12 members.
Yeah.
The highest we ever had was 8, and that was between 11, and that was between 2008 and 2012. So we've never had 13 members for one party or another. So there's never been a possibility and to be honest, even if you did have a majority, it wouldn't matter because you'd need 2/3 to overturn the mayor.
And so that kind of brings me on is like on this. I suppose, not to jump too far ahead, I don't know, Jonathan, cutting across you. It seems to me the way it's set up just makes it very, very difficult for it to have any real teeth, as you alluded to.
Yeah.
And that was everything from, so, you know, when I was looking at it before speaking to you, I was like, I would have known the numbers, you know, it's about 25 members and stuff. But when you sit down and think about it, you're like, well, then no one's ever going to have, it's possible someone could get a simple majority.
Mm-hmm.
It's unlikely anyone's ever going to have 2/3. So the whole, that whole scrutiny body is set up, not, I don't know if it was set up on purpose in this way, but it seems almost, I don't know if this, you think this is unfair, having sat on it, I don't want to be too critical. It seems designed to fail.
I think it depends on what you think its objective was. I mean, the GLA Act 1999 was a snapshot in time. So if you go back to 1999, we're talking about the early years of New Labour. And at that particular time, bearing in mind that they'd won a majority of 179 seats at the election 2 years previously. It was inconceivable, I think, to Tony Blair and his government at that time that it would be anything other than the way it was then.
Right.
So the system to elect the mayor, there was a first and second preference. Now, that was designed specifically to prevent a Conservative from ever becoming mayor, because the working assumption was that Conservatives would vote Conservative, but every other party being left of centre, even if they didn't vote Labour for their first preference, they would certainly do it for their second preference to keep the Conservatives out. But a safeguard was set in place, I think, for the Assembly, having two different electoral systems to elect people of the same status, which is the constituency members and the list members, was, I think, a safeguard to prevent there ever being a Conservative majority on the Assembly. So, and I think the framers of that legislation assumed that this is how things would be forever. Of course, things have changed. And, you know, Boris Johnson's election in 2008 and in 2012 scuppered the best laid plans, because that wasn't supposed to happen. The framers of that legislation would have been aghast at what happened. And in actual fact, I mean, you can make the argument that in the year 2000, Ken Livingstone scuppered it, because Ken Livingstone won as an independent. He didn't win as a Labour candidate. Labour tried desperately to prevent him from being their candidate. Yeah. They completely rejigged their selection rules and very ironically reintroduced the electoral quorum that they used to have. Rather than one member, one vote. If it had been one member, one vote and Livingstone had been allowed on the ballot, he would have won hands down. So it was a very interesting time. But we are now 25 years on and we are left with a system which I think, I mean, there is a place for the Assembly. If you're going to have a mayor of London, you need an Assembly. What you don't want is to give a man with a budget in excess of £20 billion a completely free ride. It's very important that there is democratic scrutiny of what he does. Now, the council leaders will say that they should do that, but I would contend that they don't have the time. Their job is to executively lead their boroughs. That is not at all the same skill set as being an effective scrutineer. And, you know, there is a relationship between City Hall and the boroughs, and that's as it should be. But to scrutinise the mayor properly, you need people that are democratically accountable for it. And I think that means an assembly. And I think that there are ways that they could improve it. If you're going to keep them, then they should look to improve the assembly, I think. And give it a bit more teeth.
Because, I asked a couple of London people, kind of Tory London people, let's say, what do you have any views on this, questions I could ask? And so one of the suggestions was to change the dynamics of the Assembly. And you've already touched on this. One of their suggestions was, why don't you have council leaders? The other suggestion is, why don't you have borough representatives, kind of increase the number? Do you think, it doesn't sound like you like the council leader's idea. What reform could you provide to the Assembly which would allow it to better scrutinise the
mayor? So I don't like the council leaders thing. As I say, their job is to be the executive leads for their boroughs. And it simply isn't the case that they would have the time to do the job effectively. Because the Assembly doesn't just meet the mayor's question time. There's a whole range of committees that take place throughout the week. Looking at the various different policy portfolio areas of the mayor, so transport, fire, planning, police, etc. What I would look to do, possibly, is have the assembly elections so they're not on the same day as the mayoral elections. So have the mayoral election 2 years later, have the assembly elections, for example, so you stagger them. And the reason for doing that is that people will tend to vote the party ticket. So if they want to vote for Sadiq Khan as mayor, they'll vote Labour across the board. But actually, within the two-year intervening period, they may think, you know what, I'm not quite happy with what Sadiq Khan is doing. So you may end up with a situation where you get a Conservative Assembly that is better able to hold the mayor to account. I would also get rid of the two-thirds thing. So give the Assembly the power of veto over the mayor's budget and over the mayor's strategies. Because if it had real teeth, if it had real power, then it might exert it.
And on a more simple majority, you mean plus one, basically.
So 13 votes defeats the mayor's budget.
Yeah.
And the mayor has to, because the mayor would then have to reach out and would have to engage with the assembly in a way that he really doesn't have to now. All he needs is a blocking minority to be able to do whatever he likes.
Yeah.
And the Labour group have shown repeatedly in the 7 years that he has been, sorry, the 8 years now that he has been the mayor, that they, even though many of the Labour members don't actually like a lot of what he is doing, they've shown repeatedly they're not prepared to stand up and veto anything that he wants to do.
I was interested, Gareth, to get an idea of a day in the life of a London Assembly member. So, and so it's from two perspectives. Obviously, first, when you've first gone in and you are essentially, I suppose, a backbencher, not to be rude, but a backbencher, obviously, then you become obviously overseeing the fire service. And then how that's different to when it's now a Labour mayor, but you're the leader of the, you're effectively the leader of the opposition on the council as the largest group opposing the Labour Party. So again, what's the difference between your sort of daily activities there? What access to information do you have that was different maybe from your time when you first came in to when you take over as group leader?
Well, I mean, when I was first elected, I mean, it wasn't supposed to happen. And very much being on the back benches, I did, I suppose, the assembly. I maintained some of the commercial work that I was doing. I went part-time doing that. And I served on, I'm trying to think which committees I was on, the environment. I was the environment lead at the time. And there were a couple of other bits and pieces that I did. As I got progressively more established there, I got much more involved. And I went on to, I decided in 2010, so a couple of years after I was there, that I wanted to get involved in a functional body. And that was the London Fire and Emergency Planning Authority, which was the political, that was like a local council that ran the London Fire Brigade. And that was at a time when there was about to be a firefighter strike about shift pattern changes. And that's when I met Susan Hall, actually, because she was appointed to the fire authority on the same day that I was. And then after 2012, I started to get more seniority once I'd got re-elected. And I think it was in 2013, I started chairing. Initially, the Labour group didn't want Conservative chairs of any of the committees, even though it was a cross-party scrutiny body. They wanted to keep the Tories out of absolutely everything. But they realised after a period of time that this was profoundly undemocratic, because even on our worst day, we were getting a third of the votes in London. And to shut us out of a non-executive scrutiny body, they finally realised that they couldn't stand that up. So they let us chair one committee, which was the Regeneration Committee. And I chaired that. But when I became leader in 2015, I was also the Conservative budget spokesman by then. And that was probably the best committee to get onto, because everything that happens at the GLA involves money. Everything. And so once you're onto that committee, particularly if you become the chairman, which I did after 2016, then you can then poke your nose into everything the mayor's doing. And I found that extremely valuable. So I would crawl all over the detail of absolutely everything, and really get a good understanding of what the mayor was about, which made me a much more effective scrutineer.
And on the, you mentioned budget. So I was going to ask this at some point. we see this across, this is a devolution issue, I think. So I'll give you just my honest opinion, which is I'm not particularly pro-devolution, because I just think you end up in a cycle of them demanding, them as anyone, Tory or Labour, demanding more and more power, but constantly blaming the central government. Yeah. And maybe this is, I spent too much time in the centre, but constantly blaming the central government for not giving them the cash to do the things that they want. So you just get a blame game. But there has been arguments made by first ministers, mayors, for more tax raising power. Because it's also fair to say, while I think they hide behind it, and I'm not talking about anyone in particular, it's also fair to say that if any of the head of the devolution bodies, if you like, want to spend more money, they want to spend more on the police or TfL or whatever, it's also true to say they can't raise a lot of money. So I could guess your answer, but should the mayor of London have more ability on tax raising powers to raise more money?
No, in a word, no. So, I mean, this particular mayor has raised council tax by 71% since he was elected. And yet standards virtually everywhere have gone off a cliff. The police are in special measures. The fire brigade are in special measures. He's not delivering affordable housing despite having record-breaking levels of funding from central government. You know, it is not a good track record of achievement. The idea of giving him even more power to take money from Londoners is not something that fills me with joy. And he has wasted absolutely no opportunity to blame everyone other than himself for his own failings. He intervenes on things that have absolutely nothing to do with him. He virtue signals to his heart's content. But his actual responsibilities, his level of achievement is negligible. And the idea of giving him more power, of course he would call for more power, because it's a perfect excuse to blame somebody else. And we've seen that with every single devolved administration that we have in the country. But the consequences actually, I mean, you know, we're not a large country. We are effectively a small island off the coast of mainland Europe. Do we really need to be behaving in this sort of federal way? I mean, if you look at the behaviour of various devolved administrations during the pandemic, for example, were they really working in the national interest? Was it really a good idea for us to be going into negotiations with the mayor of Manchester about whether or not tighter restrictions should happen? Negotiations? I'm sorry, since when is the mayor of Manchester being treated like a head of state of a foreign country? I mean, what is going on there during a health emergency? You know, these things have very big and long-lasting consequences. And, you know, I think there is a place for devolving power downwards, but I would actually have bypassed the mayor of London and devolved power down to local authorities, because people understand local authorities. It is the case that even though the mayor of London, the office of the mayor of London, is now thick end of a quarter of a century old, most people, most Londoners, don't really have any idea what the mayor of London is actually responsible for. You know, I used to find when I was going out campaigning that if I was campaigning while I was a council candidate, people would understand that. Campaigning as a member of parliament, or indeed for parliament as a parliamentary candidate, people understand that. But if I go out and knock on their door and say, oh, hello, I'm Gareth Bacon, I'm your London Assembly candidate, I'll get a completely blank look and they'll think, what on earth is that? So whenever you say that, you say I'm campaigning on behalf of the whoever the mayoral candidate is about the London mayoral elections, because they kind of got it, but they didn't really know what the mayor was for. And Sadiq Khan is deliberately blurring the lines with some of his policies. So, for example, his free school meals policy. Education is no part of his responsibility at all. And yet he is using over £100 million per annum of taxpayers' money, whilst at the same time pleading poverty for some of his other direct responsibilities in order to do something to signal his virtue.
On the, just to back you up on, we try not to be too political, but I'll back you up on this. When I was at the Home Office, we had working for Priti, had our first meeting with the Mayor of London, with Sadiq. And as you do with these things, you speak to private offices, and say, so I said to our private office, what does he want to talk about? So they said, I can't remember the exact ones, but it was roughly number one, migration. Number two, EU citizens in London, etc. And I remember saying, what about, is knife crime not up? And it said on the email, knife crime, comma, if time allows. And to your, and this is, for me, it's a general criticism of devolution, actually. And this is, for me, I won't make it specifically about, I'm going to give you that example. But my worry about devolution is that many of them don't focus on the powers they actually have and are constantly in a battle with, and it will be, I would suggest it will be the same if we have a Labour government, that on the flip side, you know, a Conservative mayor of X will probably do the same to a Labour government. So, I mean, where we are with devolution, do you think it should be, do you think it should be rolled back? Is there ways to, or is there ways to improve the systems we've got?
Well, I mean, I'm not a fan of devolution because for the reasons that I outlined earlier on, I think it weakens the fabric of the nation state. And I don't think it really advances things a great deal. I mean, we were told that, when the mayor of London was set up, it would cost less than a pint of beer. I think a week or a month, I can't remember now. But the fact of the matter is it now costs over £400 per year per household in the whole of Greater London. If you come out to my constituency, it looks very, very different to, say, Islington or Tooting, which is where the mayor of London currently lives. You know, we don't have the tube. We have probably more buses than we would have otherwise. We might have a few more police officers than we would otherwise. And we have the Freedom Pass. But other than that, there's not a great deal of benefit. And yet my constituents pay exactly the same amount of money in council tax to the Mayor of London as people that do have all of these things in central London. And so, you know, it is very questionable whether there are benefits to the whole of Greater London for the kind of devolution that we have at the moment. Now, can you roll back devolution once it's there? It's a very difficult question. I mean, if we could turn back time, I'd rather have prevented it from happening in the first place. I don't think that a Scottish Parliament has helped the United Kingdom. I don't think the Welsh Assembly has either. And the devolution to the Metro mayors, I think, is an experiment that, I mean, the people that are in post, and when your party is controlling any of these things, of course you would lionise them and you would be very, very pleased with them. But the truth is that these structures outlast your party's control. London under Boris Johnson was an optimistic, bouncy, happier place, I would contend, than it is now. But the structure is the same as it was then. Mm. So the consequences of having the wrong person in post is significant. So could we change it to make it better? Well, I said earlier on, I think in terms of the scrutiny of the mayor, I think you could by empowering the assembly. The mayor, I mean, strictly speaking, the mayor can involve him. You talked about him talking about EU citizens and other things. It is his role to be a champion for London and Londoners and EU citizens living in London. It is legitimate for him to go into that. But it is an odd priority, isn't it, to put knife crime, which is spiking to record levels. Over 1,000 people have been murdered since Sadiq Khan has been mayor of London, and he's comprehensively failed to control knife crime, for that to be on the agenda if time allows. I mean, that's an extraordinary set of priorities, isn't it? But of course, the defence line that he would present is that he is accountable at the ballot box. And he's been elected twice. The opinion polls are suggesting he'll be elected again, unfortunately. So he will say, well, Londoners don't seem to be rejecting spy priorities. And that's the problem when you do devolve like this, is that he can go completely off track because people don't really understand what his job is. He's not held accountable for it.
And to offer the challenge, because you said there about when Boris Johnson was the mayor of London, London was a more optimistic, bouncy place. Was that not just a symptom of the fact that we secured the Olympic Games and therefore Boris had the opportunity to be that ambassador, that champion of London, as well as the United Kingdom? And so ultimately, luck favoured him in terms of the circumstances in which he walked into. Or what differences have you seen between when his premiership versus someone like Sadiq Khan's in terms of actual ability to deliver? Because it's fair to say that in the first maybe 2-3 years of his first term, it was quite tumultuous. There was quite a lot of up and down. There was a lot of talk that all the fears of Boris Johnson, all the worst traits of Boris Johnson that some media types would talk about, came out in a sense of, you know, who was around him, who was advising him, how has he been delivering? And then there was that fear that 2012 could actually fall in his face, but ultimately actually, you know, came through a tough still election there. What do you think the difference is in that kind of those management styles, but also in terms of their ability to deliver in that time period?
Well, I mean, so the Olympic Games occurred halfway through Boris Johnson's mayoralty. I mean, he was mayor from 8 to 16 and it came in 2012. Obviously, he had no part in securing the Olympic Games, but he was responsible for delivering them. And so it's undeniably good fortune that the Olympics came when it did, but it could have been a disaster, and it wasn't. It was a rip-roaring success. And I think, you know, Boris certainly took advantage of the Olympics. I'm not saying that in a negative way. He benefited tremendously by the Olympics and by the profile that it gave him and the feel-good factor that came with the Olympics. But he was intensely involved in the preparations for the Olympic Games. And pushing it forward. And he was, in many ways, the face of the Olympic Games. And people sort of bought into the positivity and the upbeat nature of the way that he did it. But what people overlook, you're right to point out that the early, I think it's probably a year or so of Boris's time, was a fairly tumultuous thing. I mean, turning around what was effectively a Labour institution initially fell on rocky ground. It was when Sir Simon Milton, the former leader of Westminster Council, stepped in as Boris's chief of staff. He really took a grip of operations at central office, and Simon tragically died a couple of years after he took over. But another inspired appointment was Edward Lister, who is now, of course, Lord Lister, succeeded Simon. He was the long-standing leader of Wandsworth Council. And he really gripped the operation as well and stayed in that role for the next 5 years. So in terms of delivery, apart from the Olympic Games, which was a stunning success, people overlook the fact that when Boris became mayor of London in 2008, knife crime was reaching epidemic proportions. And he and his deputy mayor for policing, Kit Morthouse, a colleague of ours, lent into that very significantly and reduced it. They pushed knife crime down. Boris also, in his second term, cut the GLA preset by 10% with no noticeable diminution in service delivery. Whereas, as I said earlier on, Sadiq Khan has put it up by 71%. He's almost doubled the staffing at City Hall. City Hall is failing in almost every respect. So I think the mayoralty, that the position of the mayor, the person of the mayor, can have a very big impact. And Sadiq Khan has chosen to use his position to be as divisive as possible in order to push himself. He's not bringing Londoners together. He's pushing them apart. Whereas Boris did the reverse. Boris tried to pull London together and to showcase the best of London. I think Sadiq Khan is not doing that to the way that he could.
But on, so that leads me to ask this question on the kind of political side. So all the things that we've discussed about Sadiq, and I think even if I speak to people of the left and on Labour, I don't hear people try to claim to me that Sadiq's hugely popular even with his kind of core vote, if you like. But he is, as we have local elections very soon, hot favourite to win another term as London mayor. So with all the things given on, all the problems he admits to, having been there for 8 years that exist, he might blame them on someone else, he is still going to get another term. So, and if you kind of read, if you ever read about London, I think one of the most common things you'll see politically is, quote, London is a Labour city. And I was wondering, do you agree with that? Is it becoming, are the demographics meaning that London is becoming more and more Labour? It would just simply be harder. I mean, Boris was an exception anyway. He's an exceptional politician, as we've seen even more so perhaps afterwards as well, but certainly as London mayor as well. Are we waiting for someone exceptional to come? Is it essentially impossible for a kind of conservative candidate to win as mayor, or even say to get a majority? If we did move to 13, would always ever even get that on the assembly?
Well, London is no more a Labour city now than it was in 2008. You know, it is. I get very tired of listening to that statement of fact that London is a Labour city and it's irretrievably so. That simply isn't the case. And it doesn't need to be either. I mean, London is the wealthiest city by far in this country, and arguably possibly even the Western world. But it also has areas of great deprivation. It's not one big homogenous lump either. Greater London exists solely because a civil servant drew lines on a map in the 1960s and decided to call it London. You know, London is many different places. The part of London that I represent in Parliament is much more akin to Kent, which is what it historically was. I mean, we have hedgerows, farmers' fields, fields of deer and sheep and things like that all over my constituency. Two-thirds of it, if you look at it overhead, if you flew up in the sky, two-thirds of my constituency is green land. It doesn't look remotely like where we are sitting now. So London has all sorts of different parts to it. But of course, the Conservative message can reach all parts, as we saw in the 2019 general election. I mean, Jonathan, your constituency, Labour heartland area, had voted Conservative because it bought into what the Conservative Party was offering at the time. Our challenge is to find, Boris is unique, I suppose. Saying, let's find another Boris Johnson isn't very easy because there is only one. But, you know, his achievement in 2008, to put it into the context of what he achieved in 2008, of course, the Labour government was in significant decline by that point. Tony Blair had left office quite unpopularly. Gordon Brown had taken over as Prime Minister, could have gone to the country in 2007, but decided not to. Iraq had taken its toll on Labour. So people were getting a bit tired of New Labour. They were tired of the spin over substance. At the same time, the Conservative Party was on the rise nationally. People were starting to look around. And Ken Livingstone, as Mayor of London, was, I don't know, jaded, tired, divisive, quite chippy, and was becoming quite unpopular. Boris was fresh, new, interesting, funny, and relatable at the same time that people were looking away from Labour. So his achievement in 2008 was very significant. A much greater achievement, in my opinion, was him holding the mayoralty in 2012. Because by that point, he wasn't an unknown entity. He wasn't the new kid on the block. The Conservative Party by this point was back in government. So him holding London in 2012 was a gigantic achievement, in my opinion. But he did it off the back of the optimism that he could sell people. Now, our challenge is to find somebody who can do the same thing. And there are, I mean, some of what Susan Hall, I think, is pushing is in the right direction. You know, she is talking about the need to really grip the crime and law and order agenda in London, and goodness knows it needs it. She's tapped into the justifiable anger that exists in outer London over the injustice of the extension of the ultra low emission scheme. Things like this, I think, are moving in the right direction. But our job, and I think central office and the Conservative Party generally, are guilty of not taking London as seriously as they should. And I think a much sharper focus on the importance, the central importance of London and what it needs is desperately needed going into the future. And I think if we can recalibrate ourselves in that way, then I think that there is absolutely no reason whatsoever why we should be sitting here just saying, well, London's a Labour city, let's just forget about it.
I was about to say, do you think it's unfair the way London's treated? So, for example, if you look at, because MPs like myself, who will talk about Sir Keir Starmer, for example, or the Labour Party being the London bubble, M25 circuit, you know, this is what they do. Because ultimately, in my part of the world, they would say London looks like they get everything. They've got, you know, they look like they've got a tube system, they've got buses regularly, got overground system, FTSE 100 companies in there. London's got everything. So it's easy for trap for conservative politicians to take a swipe at London and say this is where everyone's always focused.
Have you ever taken a swipe at London?
I multiple times, yeah.
Isn't it full of chai latte drinking?
Avocado eating, individuals in North London. I've specifically referenced Islington, just so everyone knows. But then you've got on the other side, Sir Keir Starmer, desperate to avoid that appearance by not trying to be seen as London-centric and actually trying to say that he's actually, you know, unites the country and et cetera like that. So I suppose, is there frustration internally with the Conservative Party, maybe, that Conservative MPs should be more careful about what they say about London, because ultimately people like me saying the things I do only does damage the cause of London and colleagues like yourself, but also our councillors, assembly members and our mayoral candidates?
I think there is a certainly a semblance of truth in what you've just said there. Look, the truth is that London is the motor of the UK economy. The tax receipts that are generated in Greater London are simply staggering. You touched on that in your introduction. Talking London down or taking things away from London is a tremendous mistake. You know, it's an old cliche, but there's a lot of truth in this as well. You don't make anybody taller by cutting off somebody else's head. And the temptation to behave in what I think is quite a socialist way, actually, of taking stuff away from London to redistribute it is not a good idea. London is actually a gateway to the United Kingdom. You know, if you look to do business all around the world, people are interested in what's going on in London now. We can use London to attract people to the UK. The UK, as I said earlier on, is not a big country. We're not talking about the United States, which is absolutely gigantic, or China, which is bigger still. We're talking about a small island off the coast of Europe. London is the city that everybody is interested in. It is no coincidence that London got the Olympic Games, where Manchester and other cities before had bid for it with very compelling bids, but hadn't succeeded in doing it. London is the city that people understand internationally. What we need to do much better is use London for the good of the United Kingdom. And when the government of any description starts talking down London or start talking about taking things away from London, then I think we're on the wrong track. And we as a party need to use the influence and prestige of London to benefit the rest of the country, not simply take things from London. Growing the pie rather than reducing it is what we should be looking to do.
I think another thing for me with MB Gareth, that we've obviously got these elections coming up. You've talked about a number of colleagues, which is like James Cleverly, Kit Malthouse. Is the GLA, London Assembly, good training ground for prospective Conservative parliamentary candidates? Because I think that how many colleagues are there of you now who've all served in the London Assembly?
Well, very interesting. So I was thinking about you. I thought you might ask me this question. So I took a bit of a list before I came over here. So there are 11 former members of the Conservative group on the London Assembly that have sat in Parliament. 10 have gone on to become MPs. One is currently in the House of Lords. That's obviously Sean Bailey. So to run through them in order, Andrew Pelling, Bob Neil, Andrew Bray, Bob Blackman, Eric Ollenshaw, Victoria Borick, James Cleverly, Kit Morehouse, Kemi Badenoch, and me have all gone on to become members of Parliament. Sean
Bailey.
We'll
get one more soon as well.
We may do. We may do. Fingers crossed. We shall see what happens there. 4 from the Labour side have gone on to become members of Parliament. 2 from the Liberal Democrats. 1 was an MP. 1 became a peer. And 1 from the Green Party, who's in the House of Lords. So it is a well-trodden path from City Hall to Westminster. And there is a reason for that. It's quite a good, I suppose, halfway house between local government and national government. And, you know, a lot of people do cut their teeth there and have beaten a path to Westminster afterwards. So, and actually some have gone the other way too. So there are three from opposition from either Liberal Democrats or Labour that have either sat in the House of Commons or House of Lords or both, who then went on to be Assembly members, and three that went on to become former MPs that went on to become Assembly members, including our own Richard Tracy, who used to be sports minister for a while under Margaret Thatcher, who sadly passed away a couple of years ago, but he added a lot of value when he came onto the Assembly. And more recently, Andrew Dismal from the Labour Party, former MP, was an Assembly member for 8 years. So there is a close interconnection between the two.
Well, look, I think that's been a fascinating insight into the London Assembly and the Greater London Authority, just to make sure we get that distinction correct, and to hear what is going on. And of course, for listeners, May will be a big time, the first time that we've seen the mayoralty under the first-past-the-post system, as well as obviously local elections. Sorry, Gareth, do you want to come in there? Sorry.
Yeah, just on the electoral system. A lot of attention has been attracted to that, because what the government have done is they've dispensed with the second preferences that were previously cast. It remains to be seen how that affects voting behaviour. I'm personally a bit sceptical that it will make any difference, because no mayoral election in London has been determined by second preference votes. So
how interesting.
In every election that's taken place, whoever has been ahead on the first preference has gone on to become the mayor. Whether or not that will change things this time remains to be seen. I'm slightly sceptical that make a difference.
Well, look, as I say, that's good to know, and people should be tuning in, because the local elections are going to be big in terms of the news story happening across the country. All mayoralties, I think, are up across the country, if I'm not mistaken, as well. So that would be your Andy Streets in Birmingham, as your Ben Houchins up in Teesside. I think Andy Burnham in Greater Manchester, as well as, of course, Sadiq Khan here in London, all up for re-election. So thank you so much, Gareth, for coming in and for sharing those great stories. Thank you to everyone who's tuning in and listening. Please make sure that you hit your subscribe button, however it is you listen to your pods. Please make sure that you leave us a rating and a review, and make sure you follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Whitehall Pod UK. Thank you.
Thank you.